since my arrival, the first time that I made my way down to Southwest Florida was really, I was traveling an exhibition from the Tampa Museum of Art that was dedicated to John Cage. It was actually a tribute to John Cage, and it was his centenary. It was 2012. And he was someone who had been incredibly influential, probably the most important composer of the second half of the 20th century, but also a dear friend, very close with Bob Rauschenberg. So Cage... it's really from all Fluxus. Really, he was the progenitor of Fluxus in a way. It was really his ideas. He taught in the late 50s a class at the New School for Social Research in New York, and a lot of the original people who went on to found Fluxus sat in on those classes basically and took copious notes, and it really influenced the entire scene. But Cage also, you know, had been a part of Black Mountain College and really did the first happening. It was called Theater Piece Number One, that Bob Rauschenberg was actually playing a record player in this first happening in the 1953. So, but the title for the show actually comes from an artist whom we worked with prior. Last summer, we did a show with Philip Korner, who's another original Fluxus artist. When I made my way and became the director of the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery after the Cage thing in 2012, in 2014, the first exhibition I did here was a solo exhibition with Yoko Ono. And Yoko and John Lennon are probably the best known, maybe Nam June Paik also, of those Fluxus artists. So the idea with this exhibition was really to show you the broad scope of participants and collaborators that sort of influenced that whole generation, but also who, you know, were at the core of Fluxus. So what we're doing is kind of a historical show, but it also felt like the right time to do it because we'd done a Yoko Ono exhibition that was a major show that she made new work for. We did a Philip Korner exhibition last summer, and we had brought Benjamin Patterson, before his death, to do some performances and to give a lecture here a couple of years ago. So I spent a few days in Italy just this past summer, a couple of months ago, and got to have some lengthy exchanges with Philip Korner, who came up with the title for our show. And Fluxus, while an anti-art, it was about a kind of childlike playfulness. Philip came up with this title, Fluzuzic, because it sounded like a Dr. Seuss sort of playful title. And again, the focus of the show actually is Fluxus music. And the reason for really making that the focus was because Cage was the biggest influence in a way, but also most of the artists involved with Fluxus, Yoko Ono, Nam June Paik, all came from a kind of musical background. So a lot of the objects that they made, were instruments of sorts, and a lot of times participatory, and things were based on scores. Scores became a very important part of it, as it was a sort of anti-art. The score allowed the opportunity for anyone to kind of take authorship, to be the performer, and they often would perform each other's works. Right. So that's the sort of background for the title, you know,
okay,
why we chose it.
And Fluxus itself, the genre, I was hoping you could maybe tell us more about just its approach. It seems to have been inspired by or founded in Dadaism, this idea of challenging what art is and art's accessibility.
And the establishment in that sense, yeah. So in a way, the groundwork was laid 100 years ago with the Cabaret Voltaire and with Dada. So and they would widely acknowledge that influence. You know, people like Marcel Duchamp, Alison Knowles, who will be here to perform and to demonstrate this newly commissioned work, which we can talk about. Alison was a collaborator of Marcel Duchamp. She co-edited with John Cage his seminal book Notations that had kind of graphic scores by everyone from the Beatles to Stockhausen to all of the important Fluxus artists. But it does sort of come from Dada, and there was this moment in the early 60s when Fluxus began. The founder officially of Fluxus, who sort of coined that term or came up with that title, was George Matunas. And George Matunas was actually in Wiesbaden, Germany, and he was working on Stars and Stripes for the military. And so it was at a point at a moment when in Germany there was a lot of sort of new music performance happening, a lot of experimental stuff that was going on. So, you know, people were making their way to Darmstadt, for example, including Cage and Stockhausen and others. And Machunas began, I think, on the military budget to be bringing some of the performers that were in that group, including Cage. And they did a newest music festival in Wiesbaden, Germany in 1962, which actually was covered on live television and caused great controversy and essentially launched Fluxus in that sense. So as a organized group, and that included people like Benjamin Patterson again performing there and Alison Knowles and others, as an organized group, it dates to 1962. But again, it was one of the first, if not really the first, both international art movement, but one that included women. There were strong groups of sort of Fluxus artists that were in Japan, that were certainly in New York, that were throughout Europe. Also Milan Knežák, who was included in this exhibition, who was in the Czech Republic. So he was the head of Fluxus East, you know. And they were all connected. There was a kind of network of people doing this kind of activity. And it was, you know, interesting in the context of the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery, I think. Rauschenberg always talked about working in the gap between art and life. That's sort of the one of the most famous quotes of Bob Rauschenberg, is that he was working in the gap between art and life. Well, Dick Higgins, one of the founding Fluxus members, coined the term intermedia. And for him, again, intermedia was, you know, taking music and taking painting, or taking two different disciplines, essentially, and creating a third, creating a new. He would do diagrams of these things to describe what intermedia was and its history and its chronology, as did, in a way, Machunas, too, would make these charts. But there is a sort of well-known chart that was made by Dick Higgins that is really conflating art and life, and where the two bubbles cross over is the word Fluxus. So whereas Rauschenberg was working in the gap between art and life, Fluxus was about the conflation of art and life. And artists like Alison Knowles, who, you know, we can, again, talk a bit more about. Alison Knowles, one of her most famous works is actually a piece called Make a Salad. And it's as simple as making a salad. And this is a person, again, who not only understood, you know, the importance of the work that was being done in the late 50s and through the early 60s, but was coming with her own life experience in that she was, you know, she was married. She, you know, the responsibilities of women at that point in time were largely societally seen as being mothers and or in the kitchen and those sorts of things. So the idea of making a salad really spoke to, you know, what some would have called women's work or something to that effect. And so Fluxus took on and incorporated things that might have seemed absurd, like the idea of making music using food. It's very central to the theme of the current exhibition that we have, and people will be able to participate in that as well. So it's a very participatory approach to sort of everything that also comes out of Dada, you know. The Fluxus artists were never interested in making objects for, you know, wealthy collectors to own or to donate to museums to be kept forever. You know, there was a kind of peripheral character who was connected with Fluxus called Gustav Metzger, who in the 1950s, actually I think it was the 40s, wrote the Manifesto on Autodestructive Art and had these ideas not only about destroying museums, but this idea that in nature there's entropy. Why would we ever imagine keeping art forever or having it be collected and preserved? His thought was that everything has a life. Everything is sort of experiential, but it also has an end as well. And I think Fluxus came to it with that idea. It could be continually recreated. The notion of the score, again, was very important, that people, you know, could perform each other's work, but also in time, those scores could be reperformed.
Can you say a little bit more about these event scores? Because I love that sort of play on words. You have like a musical score, which is obviously much more exact in describing what it wants the musician to do. An event score, it seems, you know, it's really just like almost like what I said when we were speaking earlier, is like stage directions. And then there's so much that's just left to the individual performer to fill in.
Yeah. Well, and in a sense, like musical scores are that way too. You know, I mean, the idea that, you know, music had been handed down by what one would hear until the advent of creating a kind of score. And that history is not that long, you know, in a way, this notion of staff notation or musical notation. And frankly, most of, if not all of the artists that were very connected with Fluxus had that kind of training. They could easily, you know, have written staff notation. You know, Ben Patterson famously, I think it's a score by, I'm not sure if it's Chopin or someone that is like, you know, something that's frequently played by symphonies. He would write this score in front of an audience, and then he would take a big bucket and have a giant toothbrush, and he would erase the chalkboard with this big toothbrush as a sort of sound work, as a musical work. But he could very easily, you know, inscribe a well-known musical score in terms of staff notation and so forth. That said, I think that with all of these things, it's about allowing a certain amount of creativity and freedom. I mean, you know, for the Fluxus artists, it was very much about freedom. It wasn't about, and that's why it was sort of seen or discussed as a kind of anti-art. It was about giving people some sense of direction. For people like Cage, you know, everyone sort of sees him as this great permission giver in terms of the work. But when you talk about the silent piece or 433, it's very specific. There is a score. You know, there are two versions of the score. But while it's not about interacting with the piano to make sound, it is in three parts. I mean, in terms of your interaction with the piano, about lifting the top of the piano, and it's timed movements. It's three movements, right? So for Cage, he expected that people follow the score precisely. For some of the other Fluxus artists, many of these things are much more open-ended, as you say, too.
And I don't know if cognitive dissonance is the correct term to use here, but I'm thinking about how this movement is so rooted in the idea of not so much making art more accessible, but making people understand that art is in places that they never would have thought before. But at the same time, that should increase its accessibility, but I get the impression a lot of these Fluxus artists' performance, you know, then and even now, are largely misunderstood. A performance where somebody just slowly lifts a violin over their head and then just smashes the heck out of it. Or, you know, I've heard interviews with Alison Knowles talking about performing Make a Salad and people just getting up and walking out. They don't get it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's true. I mean, I do think that, you know, particularly when you think about and talk about an artist like Yoko Ono, and again, it's our great pleasure and sort of honor, of course, too, to not only have done the show in 2014 here and to have Yoko make work for this exhibition and for the public more broadly, you know, in the form of the billboard that was created at that point in time and a new one that actually has just been posted on Friday, that in conjunction with this exhibition that has been done specifically for us, and it's a new billboard. You know, it's not a message that will be found anywhere else at present. So, you know, for her, those things are very much a kind of public action, a call to engagement, you know, giving out buttons as she did, and Ono cord little lights, you know, that were given to everyone who sort of came to visit during the Imagine Peace exhibition here. I think that there is that sense of trying to find a way to engage. You know, these are people certainly like Yoko, who also has publicly distributed her music and who has, you know, taken political stances at various times as well. And the messages are sort of simple. I mean, I think that it's not hard for one to understand this notion of loving the earth or being a good patron to the earth. And that's what, you know, Yoko's billboard and messages people will see as they come up 41, just south of Gladiolus, heading northbound, it says, "I love you, Earth," Yoko Ono, 2017. And that was after, you know, some discussion, because my initial thinking and kind of proposal to Yoko, she had done some years ago another billboard that was called Fly, and it simply said Fly. And the last billboard that we did with her here in town was quite near Page Field Airport. And I kind of thought Fly would be a great one if we sighted it in the same place. Maybe we'd get a picture of, you know, an airplane landing or taking off in front of. But and Yoko had done an album called Fly. So because of this music connection, that album had instruments that were commissioned by the great late artist Joe Jones, who made self-playing instruments, who was a seminal Fluxus artist as well. It seemed like that would make perfect sense. And Yoko wrote back basically saying, you know, now's not the time for that message. I'd like to make something new and specific for Fort Myers, Southwest Florida. The idea was, you know, it needed to be I Love You, Earth. And as it turned out, you know, Yoko had done a song actually called I Love You, Earth. And there's some reference to that in her book Acorn as well. So there are those kind of connections. And the more I've sort of thought through this over time as we've worked with Lamar to make the billboard happen, you know, I can't help but think that, like, sort of the biggest instrument is what we are attached to every day. The earth is an instrument. It resonates. It's, you know, creating sound. So I Love You, Earth seems really fitting for the exhibition now. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure at first, but yeah.
Well, it even fits in with what's going on in the news locally. Just within the past 7 days, we've seen a major shakeup of folks in leadership positions in the state legislature. And you have this particular environmental committee where the chairman of that committee has been taken off, and they've put Lauren Book in charge, a freshman senator. And they're thinking that that's going to have a much bigger impact on a proposed anti-fracking measure actually making it out of the state Senate in 2018. And that's a central issue for Yoko.
Yeah, Yoko has done billboards related to fracking. I mean, I think this one, you know, certainly...
It's broader than that.
It's broader than that, and I think, you know, she made the decision not to make it terribly political, but I do think those messages clearly are there, and her interest and intent is there, and she does it with all heart. I mean, it's truly, you know, a message that, you know, resonates deeply for her. So the hope is that, you know, everyone will kind of have that experience. We haven't put, you know, the college logo or the gallery logo on it or any of that. It's really a standalone artwork. It's a public artwork that is kind of a gift from Yoko and a gift from us for the community. So hopefully people will make the connection that Yoko once again is here and in the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery, and there are other works here that are kind of interesting that are you know, that will be representing her in the context of this exhibition.
And, you know, I know there's a lot of artists that are being represented in the show and the connections between them. But I kind of wanted to focus a bit specifically on Alison Knowles because she will be here, because she'll be coming here for it. She was something of a student of John Cage's, but not so much in the traditional sense.
Yeah. Well, Cage, again, you know, in the late 50s, of course, he had been at Black Mountain College, and that's where he had initial exchanges with Bob Rauschenberg. In the late 50s, you know, he was asked to teach a course that has become this sort of legendary thing at the New School for Social Research in New York. And most of the sort of founding members, in a way, of Fluxus either were really in the class, or most of them, you know, had already had educations. So a lot of them were sort of sitting in when Cage would lecture. And so one of the things that's in the exhibition actually is a facsimile, but of the notebooks of George Brecht, who had been in Cage's classes. So some of his notation will be in the exhibition that really very specifically taps into Cage's influence in that sort of way. But Alison, you know, again, had collaborated with Marcel Duchamp and had this very deep relationship with John Cage over many years, to the extent that in 1962, as is represented in sort of interesting ways in the exhibition, she co-founded the New York Mycological Society. Cage and Alison were great experts when it came to mushroom hunting, essentially. And it was really Alison that he would tap on a pretty much daily basis at certain times of year to go out into the woods with him for hours and sort of get lost finding mushrooms. So, and Allison for us, remarkably, has built the largest interactive work of her career in that sense. There was a work made in the 1970s, actually initially for an avant-garde art festival that had been organized by Charlotte Moorman, 1974-75, and it's called Bean Garden, and it's an 8 by 12 foot new construction that is filled with more than 3,000 pounds of Great Northern beans. And we invite visitors to take off their shoes and actually make their way around walking in this bean garden, which simultaneously, as one becomes aware in walking through, is amplified. So the entire environment becomes a sort of instrument, but you're walking on beans in this kind of remarkable meditative way. It's quite therapeutic. You actually feel on your feet this kind of remarkable experience while hearing the sounds of your feet, you know, sort of pushing their way through 3,000 pounds of beans.
Very interesting concept, the idea that, you know, through music, I mean, what you're getting in terms of music is just the resonance of this organic matter that you are interacting with.
That's right. And again, you know, there's another piece that seems totally absurd in a way, but the original drawing for it, or the initial drawing for it, was part of the Silverman collection, which was recently donated to the Museum of Modern Art. So the first score for this work by Philip Korner, who came up with our title, Fluzuzic, is a piece called Carrot Chew. And that Philip has sent his banners for Carrot Chew, which are four large panels that are printed that give you instruction in making sounds or noise, you know, with carrots. So at the opening on Friday the 25th from 6 to 8, we'll be handing out carrots so that people can actually participate and make sounds, make music based on Philip's score for Carrot Chew by chewing carrots.
Is there going to be an element of this, you know, either at the opening of the exhibition Friday or even beyond that, where folks can take something of a guided tour? Because I feel like there's so much about this that you're not going to get if you don't have the background already.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the great things here at the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery is that, one, we always have a very informed guard, and always as well, twice daily, we have volunteer docents who are incredible. We have 20 plus folks who have volunteered their time, many for decades, who go through kind of extensive docent training with every exhibition and who are quite capable of taking people through those exhibitions and giving, you know, greater explanation. It is one of those things that actually Bob Rauschenberg never really liked having much signage or having explanations, but we like doing it in a more personal sort of one-on-one way. As people enter the gallery, they're always invited to, you know, take a little tour with one of our docents. So that will happen. In addition to that, again, these participatory pieces, you know, people will really be invited to do that. Some of those things will be quite evident. The idea that you can take off your shoes and walk around in this, you know, this bean garden, for example. And then with specific events over the run of the exhibition, it runs through November 11th, we're going to be, you know, bringing other guests. Allison Knowles is going to do an 11 o'clock demonstration Friday morning of the bean garden and a little bit of a Q&A, informal, and then she'll be at the opening, probably continuing to demonstrate the bean garden. And then in October, our plan is to bring Jeffrey Hendricks, who's another participating original Fluxus artist, now in his mid-80s, and there may be two or three other people during the run of this show that perhaps don't have a connection with Fluxus per se, but are dealing in kind of experimental sound and or music. So actually, Monday the 28th at 2 o'clock in the gallery, we're going to have Maria Chavez. This is a collaboration with the Robert Rauschenberg Foundation's residency program and Ann Brady there. One of their resident artists during this six-week period is a kind of internationally renowned experimental turntablist and performer, sound artist, who is named Maria Chavez again. She's a Peruvian descent. She, I think, lives in Brooklyn. And she's going to be coming and performing on turntable in the gallery on the Monday following the open.
Well, Jade Dillinger, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, John. Great to see you.